Trump administration is changing the rules for asylum seekers. Observers warn we've seen what happens in Europe when the immigration system gets overwhelmed.
Understaffed, under-resourced asylum agencies struggling to manage these flows, people becoming a lot more critical about the way it's being managed and the impact on civil society, on social safety nets.
Also today, nations vowed to stop cutting down the world's forests, but basic economics are getting in the way.
Cutting down forests continues to be much more lucrative than keeping them standing.
Also, France dunks on the U.S. hoops dynasty.
Finds his way into the lane and drives and scores!
And try to wrap your head around this, a proposed trash dump in Russia nearly the size of Manhattan. I'm Marco Werman. Those stories and more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. On Twitter, President Trump called it a big win. But south of the border, there's a lot of concern about the Supreme Court's ruling on who can request asylum in the U.S. The court says for now, people at the U.S.-Mexico border have to ask for asylum in the first country they traveled through to get to the U.S. Mexico's Foreign Minister Marcelo Ebrard told reporters today, obviously, we don't agree with it. The ruling means that a lot of Central Americans headed for the U.S. must instead seek asylum in Mexico.
For me, this is a recipe for chaos.
Graciela Zamudio is a lawyer in Tijuana specializing in international human rights law.
This means that the Mexican asylum system would get overwhelmed. It is already overwhelmed, but it would be way more overwhelmed by this decision.
It's clear that the U.S.-Mexico border is having a really hard time dealing with the numbers of asylum seekers. How do you respond to that, and what is the solution?
Well, I think the solution is that both countries comply with the law. You know, the U.S. is bound to the international law as well as Mexico in terms of allowing the people who have started an asylum process in their territory to remain there. And the fact that Mexico is allowing this also makes the country responsible for all the violations of human rights that people in this situation is suffering. I mean, most of them don't have access to legal representation, which in the process of the U.S. asylum seeking process, it is basically the recipe to lose it.
If the U.S. doesn't have enough resources to process the asylum seekers, and Mexico doesn't sound like it, we heard there's barely 50 agents to process the asylum seekers there, is your solution to just get these countries to hire more agents?
Well, that would definitely be something very good to do. Being such a powerful country and putting so much money in things like militarizing the border, it makes me feel that what we are facing is an unwillingness of the state to actually solve the problem. They can put all that money in making the system actually work the way the law says it should. Because in this situation in which we are, Mexico basically is like plastic bags on the street on a windy day. You know, we're just going like from one side to the other without really establishing which we want to be our international policy on migration issues.
Graciela Zamudio is an attorney specializing in international human rights law in Tijuana, Mexico. Thank you for being with us, Graciela.
Thank you.
There's also concern that the pressure on Mexico to deal with additional asylum seekers will create a migration crisis like the one Europe faced beginning in 2015. That was so divisive, it led to a rise in nationalism and xenophobia across the continent. Chris Ramon is an analyst with the Bipartisan Policy Center in Washington.
We're going to see a repeat of what happened in the European refugee crisis. Mexico is going to have to start taking on more migrants because of this regulation. And that can cause serious strains on social infrastructure, social safety nets, jobs, like, you know, the economy, and push a country that's already starting to basically push back against the reception of migrants. Mexican polling shows that they're very much in favor of a hardline position, push that Mexican public or that segment of the Mexican public to make it potentially larger. And we saw this in Europe, especially in Greece and Italy, where the Dublin III regulations, which is a first entry agreement across the EU, pushing back migrants into Greece and Italy during the initial stages of that crisis. And what you saw is the same effects. Understaffed, under-resourced asylum agencies struggling to manage these flows, people becoming a lot more critical about the way it's being managed and the impact on civil society, on social safety nets and what have you, and then eventually starting to embrace more hardline xenophobic positions. So that's, I think, the concern I have with what's going to happen in Mexico.
And the organized criminal networks that are so heavily involved in smuggling, are they going to continue? Will they be charging more? And will there be people still determined to get across the border?
I think that's what's going to happen. I think we have two scenarios that we could potentially see happen. Individuals who now are looking at what's going to be happening, you know, in Central America, Central American migrants are going to look at this and say, you know what? I think it's time for us to no longer apply for asylum, but to actually just get past CBP entirely. Up until this point, we've been seeing these migrants arriving at ports of entry or presenting themselves to CBP officers between ports of entry to seek asylum, regardless of whether they had an eligible claim or not. But now I think we might see these individuals trying to just simply pay the smugglers to get them into the United States, which is what we saw prior to this recent wave of individuals arriving at the U.S.-Mexico border. That's always been the case historically.
So kind of a return to those risky routes into the United States.
Exactly. There's another riskier route, I think. Right now it's hypothetical, but I'm going to be curious to see what happens is, what happens if you want to take a boat from Guatemala and then go try to find a part of California or Texas to try to find a way into that and then try to seek asylum? I think that's a lot more hypothetical, but I think one of the things that we've seen with other large-scale migration crises is that if you shut off one way for individuals to enter a country to seek asylum, sometimes they will find other ways. We saw this in the European refugee crisis, that once the eastern flank of Europe was sort of closed off, more individuals took riskier routes through the Mediterranean from Libya to Italy. And that's the question here. Are people going to take even riskier routes than they already have because of this decision and because of this regulation?
Chris Ramone with the Bipartisan Policy Center in Washington. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Mexico, China, North Korea, Iran, Yemen, all places that the next president of the United States will have to deal with. There has not been that much talk so far on the Democratic campaign trail about foreign policy, not too dissimilar from previous election cycles, but things could change tonight. 10 presidential hopefuls are facing off in a debate in Houston. The World's Sarah Birnbaum looks at one key area where the Democratic candidates align, military intervention.
Before we talk about this Democratic primary, let's talk about last Democratic primary. I know it feels like a long time ago, but I'm going to take you back. ISIS was in control of big swaths of Iraq and Syria, and Hillary Clinton, who was running for president, gave a speech in 2015 at the Council on Foreign Relations in New York.
Baghdad needs to accept arming Sunni and Kurdish forces in the war against ISIS. But if Baghdad won't do that, the coalition should do so directly.
In this speech, she called for more U.S. intervention, for a no-fly zone, and for arming rebels.
We should retool and ramp up our efforts to support and equip viable Syrian opposition units.
It's hard to imagine a Democratic presidential candidate saying something like this today. Dan Dresner, a foreign policy analyst at Tufts Fletcher School, thinks the shift in the party and in the electorate has a lot to do with the forever wars in Iraq and Afghanistan.
There's two things going on. The first is a sober policy recognition that neither of these military interventions have paid off in any way what we thought they would do. And so they are net minuses in terms of advancing America's security interests. But there is also just the gut level emotional, we are sick of constantly intervening everywhere.
And the candidates have gotten the message. This video was compiled by the New York Times.
Would there be American troops in Afghanistan at the end of your first term?
No.
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 There would not.
There would not. I suspect not.
You get the picture. Not every Democratic candidate supports a full withdrawal by 2024, but they all want to get the troops out of Afghanistan. And so does Donald Trump, by the way. They all want to end U.S. involvement in Yemen, and most support decreased military spending. It's safe to say that as a group, they're less hawkish than Hillary Clinton and even Barack Obama. Now, that doesn't mean there aren't shades of gray, says Dan Dresner.
I think you can argue there are two sort of lanes.
He says one lane is personified by Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders. They're more dovish on foreign military intervention.
They're suspicious about it. You know, they feel that it essentially these are resources that could be better spent on a stronger social safety net.
We must refocus our security policies by reining in unsustainable and ill-advised military commitments and adapt our strategies overseas for the new challenges we see in this
country. Our job is to make sure that we commit more resources to taking care of people than we do on weapons designed to kill them.
Then you've got candidates like Pete Buttigieg and Joe Biden, who I think are perhaps a little less dovish.
Now, our military capabilities exist, of course, for a reason. We stand ready to use force under specific lawful circumstances and when there is no peaceful alternative.
I have long argued that we should bring home the vast majority of our combat troops from the wars in Afghanistan and the Middle East and narrowly focus on our mission to deal with Al-Qaeda and ISIS in the region.
That was Joe Biden, and before that, Pete Buttigieg. And you can tell they're more open to military intervention, but it's all relative.
Biden and Warren might not agree on everything in foreign policy, but I guarantee you they agree on a lot more than they would agree with Donald Trump on anything.
I asked Dan Dresner what foreign policy questions he'll be watching out for in tonight's debate, like maybe a strategy to combat ISIS or how to handle Iran.
What I'll be looking for from them, to be honest, is an indication that they actually care about the issue and that they care about knowing things.
He says the most dangerous presidents are not the ones who are too hawkish or too dovish, but the ones who are uninformed. For The World, I'm Sarah Birnbaum.
Revolutions have a soundtrack. Yankee Doodle in 1776. In 1960s Congo, they rallied around the independence cha-cha-cha. In Ukraine, it was indie band pop music. It's now 2019, and in Hong Kong, this defiant tune, Glory to Hong Kong, has become a rallying cry for the pro-democracy movement there.
In the lyrics, there is one line that goes, Hong Kong shall be liberated when the dawn comes. As brothers and sisters, we fight for justice. This is revolution of our times.
Michael Lee is a photographer based in Hong Kong. He says this anthem came together the way a lot of this summer's protest movement has, crowdsourcing and anonymous contributions. It all began with a composer whose full name is not known posting this instrumental version online. People sent him recordings of themselves singing it and gave their own lyrical suggestions. The composer made some adjustments, and Michael Lee says it caught on.
It started to gain momentum when the soccer fans started to sing it at the FIFA World Cup qualification match held in Hong Kong 2 days ago.
Yep, just 2 days ago, protesters sang Glory to Hong Kong inside and outside the stadium. Since then, they've been belting it out on the streets, in flash mobs at malls, and not to be outdone, supporters of Beijing are singing their songs and waving Chinese flags. Just today at one of Hong Kong's biggest shopping centers, the two sides had a singing battle and tried to drown each other out. Better than throwing rocks at each other, Hong Kong doesn't have its own national anthem. That's because it's a semi-autonomous territory. Protesters hope their new song could catch on as an anthem, even if it's unofficial. Okay, cute alert, we're talking pandas. One more quick note here. Twin panda cubs were born at the Berlin Zoo 2 weeks ago. A German newspaper got in on the awe factor and held a naming contest. The most popular names suggested by readers, Hong and Kong. Problem though, Mama and Papa Panda are on loan from China. The Berlin Zoo told the Chinese newspaper, don't worry, we're not getting pulled into politics with pandas. So maybe a little less awe. You're with The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. 5 years ago, nations and corporations signed a pledge to cut deforestation in half by 2020. Their report card is now out, and it is not good. Deforestation around the globe has actually increased by more than 40%. To make that visual, it'd be like every year an area of forest the size of the United Kingdom disappearing. Stephanie Rowe is one of the lead authors of that report. She's a research scientist at the University of Virginia. Rowe says cutting down forests continues to be more lucrative than keeping them standing.
Just looking at the economic development in tropical countries, for example, you can clearly see this disparity. There are billions of dollars of finance going towards forest-destroying activities, for example, commercial agriculture, and only about 1.5% of development finance actually goes towards forest protection and restoration.
So just to be clear, what's at stake if deforestation continues?
What's at stake here is the future of our climate and the future of our biodiversity, as well as the fact that the planet becomes a lot warmer and more uncomfortable to live in. Forests contribute to making the planet warmer because it contributes about 10% of total emissions from deforestation, but it also absorbs 30% of all anthropogenic emissions currently. So there's a lot at stake in terms of what happens if we continue to deforest the way we have.
There are some success stories in your report. Indonesia is one of them. What are the reforms there that are making a difference?
So Indonesia is a standout example of the progress that can be made with deforestation down more than about 30% since 2016. And mostly government action has been central in making that change because they enacted a moratorium on peatland conversion. So peatlands currently store the most carbon of any forest globally. And the government has made a policy essentially to halt all conversion of peatlands. But I do want to add, however, that there are reports over the last couple of days of forest fires currently in Indonesia. So while we should really celebrate the positive progress that Indonesia is making, we can't turn our back. We have to continue to monitor the state of forests and accelerate action as much as possible.
Now, this report that you were part of was released in the lead up to this big UN climate summit that's happening in New York as part of the General Assembly in about 10 days or so. The UN Secretary General is going to be asking countries to make newer, even more ambitious policies. And your report suggests that the promises made 5 years ago in the New York Declaration of Forests did not have much of an impact. Does your report tell us anything about how these big agreements work or apparently are not working?
In 2015, during the Paris Agreement, many countries did include land and specifically addressing deforestation and forest restoration in their nationally determined contributions, which are pledges that countries are making to reduce their emissions. But the ambition was not as high as, you know, it should have been. And also, they really weren't quantified. So they weren't concrete actions on what exactly they were going to be doing to address deforestation and forest restoration. And the fact that the report paints a pretty grim picture of progress so far, I think we hope that it serves as a wake-up call for these governments and businesses as they enter the discussions at the UN Climate Summit.
Stephanie Rowe is a research scientist at the University of Virginia and one of the lead authors of the New York Declaration on Forests Assessment Report. Stephanie, thanks for your time.
Thanks so much.
North Korea is still firing off mixed signals and missiles. This week, Pyongyang conducted its 8th round of missile launches since July. This happened just hours after North Korean officials said they're willing to resume stalled nuclear talks with the U.S. The weapons being launched appear to be short-range, missiles that could strike South Korea. Jenny Town is with 38 North. They provide analysis on North Korea, and she spoke with my colleague Carol Hills.
This short-range testing, conventional system testing, started May of this year. And I think a lot of it is really targeted towards South Korea and a lot of frustration coming from the North Koreans about South Korea's inability to deliver on the commitments that they've made in the Inter-Korean Accords. You've seen several missives coming from Kim Jong-un himself and other North Korean media towards President Moon, sort of challenging him to move forward and not wait for the approval and cooperation of the international community, especially the United States. And that's obviously a decision that South Korea is not going to make. They don't want to be in violation of international law in order to pursue the inter-Korean agenda. However, it's really hampered their ability to move forward. And so I think you see a lot of this frustration being expressed now in a very militant, aggressive, antagonistic way. And it's unfortunate that when they started doing this in May, that the response from the U.S. really set the precedent of that these short-range tests are okay, as long as it doesn't violate that moratorium on medium and long-range missile testing.
But aren't these weapons tests by Pyongyang also a way to kind of get the attention of Washington and say, hey, hey, come on, let's talk again?
Certainly they have the added bonus, bonus effect of, you know, signaling to Washington that, yes, they are still improving their capabilities. It falls just below the threshold of what President Trump has said would actually derail the negotiation process, which is these long-range missile tests. So I think they've been very careful not to cross that line to keep the door to negotiations with the U.S. open. But certainly, I think they're looking at this to help build leverage in that process, both with South Korea and the United States.
Are the kinds of weapons that North Korea has been testing in recent months, do they show any kinds of technological advancements that worry people?
Certainly, these are new systems that do have added capabilities to North Korea's ability to conduct war in the region, especially the new short-range ballistic missile systems that they've tested have an altitude that, you know, falls right in between what the South Korean U.S. Patriot missile systems and the THAAD systems are able to defend against. And so it does increase their short-range capabilities. It does exploit some of the weaknesses in some of the combined missile defense forces.
Well, isn't that worrisome?
Absolutely, especially for South Korea. And it does make the political mood towards negotiations and continuing negotiations in South Korea much more difficult, of course.
How has South Korea responded?
South Korea has been very cautious in their responses, trying again to keep the door to negotiations open. Throughout this whole testing period, all 10 rounds of testing, they've been very reluctant to label these as ballistic missiles. They tend to label them instead as projectiles.
Is projectile, though, just a euphemism?
Basically, yeah. So these are basically short-range ballistic missiles and technically illegal under UN Security Council resolutions. How the world chooses to respond to them, of course, is a political response. And you've seen the European members of the UN Security Council make a statement against them. But you see a lot of reluctance in Asia, as well as in the U.S. administration, to overstate the importance of these tests right now.
Yeah, it's interesting because President Trump is sort of downplaying the significance of these tests. Why?
You know, it's a political decision, obviously, of, you know, what constitutes a breach of the spirit of the negotiations going on. President Trump drew that line to say, as long as it doesn't violate the moratorium on the medium range and long range missile testing, that basically the U.S. wasn't going to make a big deal about it. But it certainly is a cause for concern, and it puts South Korea in a very difficult position as to how they should respond and how they should be thinking about the situation.
That was Jenny Town with 38 North, speaking with my colleague Carol Hills. You're listening to The World.
The World's podcast is brought to you by Goldman Sachs. For insights from leading thinkers at Goldman Sachs on the state of markets, industries, and the global economy, listen to the podcast Exchanges at Goldman Sachs. You'll hear discussions on a variety of topics from a variety of sectors with far-reaching implications, including global and regional growth forecasts, finding value in today's investing climate, the impact of technology on markets, and much, much more. That's Exchanges at Goldman Sachs, available on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, SoundCloud, and Google Play, and at gs.com/podcast.
Israeli voters are conflicted. Corruption charges swirl around Prime Minister Benjamin Bibi Netanyahu.
But I think that Bibi is the most qualified. If you choose, you want the country to be okay, I think it's Bibi.
Will Bibi get another chance? We visit an area known as the Ohio of Israel to find out. That's coming up here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, WGBH, PRI, and PRX. Israelis are heading back to the polls next week. It's kind of a do-over. The second time this year, Israel is holding a national election. Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu failed to form a coalition government last time round. Snap elections could give him another chance. But Netanyahu is facing multiple corruption charges. So will Israelis come out to vote for him? And is Likud party again, 6 months later? The World's Matthew Bell went to speak with voters in a place that's been described as the Ohio of Israel.
The city of Rehovot is in the center of Israel, and politically speaking, it's right in the center as well. In past elections, the vote here has been sort of a bellwether. Jewish voters here pretty much track with the way they vote across the country.
Itai Levy runs a little shop in the center of town where he repairs and sells watches. Like his parents, he was born and raised in Rehovot. Levy's a stylish guy. Two earrings, a necklace, ripped jeans, a shaved head. He's happy to talk politics with me, but he's also frustrated.
You cannot trust nobody right now.
Levy says the politicians are slinging all kinds of dirt in the home stretch of this election, trying to get an edge. In past elections, he says the choice was easy for him. Likud, Bibi Netanyahu, all the way, because he kept the country safe.
Usually I voted for Bibi.
But this time you're thinking maybe no.
This time I think that we had enough.
Levy's main complaint about Netanyahu is this. After all these years in office, the prime minister is part of the problem. Israeli society is bitterly divided between left and right, religious and secular, Levy says. And the country needs someone new to help foster some unity. We'll come back to Levy later on. But he was not the only person here telling me they're done with Netanyahu.
My name is Elisheva Krief. I'm 69 years old. I'm Israeli. I was born here. My parents are Holocaust survivors, came from Hungary.
So when you're thinking about who to vote for, what's the number one issue on your mind? What do you care about the most?
To get rid of Bibi.
And Kriev says she has voted more than once for Netanyahu in the past, but now the prime minister could be indicted for corruption. So he needs to go, she says.
Are you excited to vote on Tuesday?
Yes, yes. I believe I will change things by my vote. The only one, yes, I have.
And did you decide who to vote for yet, or you're still deciding?
Kahol Lavan, yes.
Kahol Lavan, the blue and white party, led by the former Army General Benny Gantz. Kriev says she's voting for the party because they're running number two in the polls. The more votes they get, the better position they will be to form a stable government, she says, without bringing one of the Jewish Orthodox parties into a ruling coalition. That's an important issue as well for Tamar Gross. She's walking with her partner, Nave, and their three-week-old baby boy. They tell me they won't vote for Netanyahu because if he's elected, he's likely to join with one of the conservative religious political parties in the next government.
I really don't mind that people will be religious and keep kosher, but I don't think if someone wants to live a secular life, I don't think he should live a religious life because it's laws that were established in like 50 years ago. So,
but many people I speak with in Rehovot say they are sticking with Likud, like truck driver Gabriel Sabayev. He says his whole family is voting for Bibi, and so is he.
There's no one else. There's no one else that can lead the country. He and Trump have a very good relationship. It won't happen with Benny Gantz. I hope this time he'll be able to put together a government.
And this brings us back to Itai Levy, the guy at the watch shop. We talk for a while, and as I ask him questions about who he's going to vote for and why, Levy's attitude starts to evolve right in front of me.
I think that Kahol Lavan, they are good people, but they don't know how to lead the country.
They don't have the experience?
No, of course not. They have a military experience, but not leading experience, you know what I mean? And this is why I'm a little bit confused with my choice.
After a few more minutes of conversation, things become clear for Levy. He says he voted for Netanyahu in April. So when I ask him about this politician or that one, Levy says, you know, come to think of it,
I think that Bibi is the most qualified from all of them. if you choose, you want the country to be okay, I think it's Bibi. And if I'm still talking to you now, I think about it, and I'm probably going to vote another time for Bibi.
You just talked yourself into voting for Netanyahu.
Right now, when I'm talking to you, I still, I think about it, and I said to myself, yeah.
For The World, Matthew Bell, Rehovot, Israel.
Benjamin Netanyahu's office is also making waves in the U.S. today. They're calling out a news report from Politico a blatant lie. Politico published a story today saying that Israel was responsible for an operation to eavesdrop on the White House. File this under with friends like these. Now, there's no doubt that bugging devices were found a couple of years ago, but today former senior intelligence officials cited by Politico said an FBI investigation pointed clearly at Israel. Besides calling it a lie, Netanyahu's office also said that Israel has a longstanding commitment to not engage in any intelligence operations in the U.S. The FBI declined to comment on the matter. Whatever the truth is in this case, there is a long and colorful history of nations spying on their allies. The World's History Guy Chris Wolf is here. What else do we know about these bugs found near the White House in 2017?
Well, there was a routine surveillance operation by the Department of Homeland Security to test to see how widespread these devices were, because it had been anecdotally reported that diplomats were using them extensively in Washington to monitor phone calls and data usage and even record the conversations of key officials, including and up to potentially the president. And they find these devices called stingrays. Technically, they're known as international mobile subscriber identity catchers. So what they do is they act as a bogus cell phone tower to capture the location, the number. But if you get the high-end ones, they can even record those conversations, capture text messages and any other kind of data usage.
Why would one nation need to spy on one of its closest allies?
Well, there's all kinds of legitimate interests for one nation to keep up, even with what their friends are up to. They may be allies, but they have competing interests. Maybe it's industrial. They need to keep ahead of technology that's coming out. And one way to do that is to spy on your friends. Another important consideration is to avoid embarrassing surprises. So if you hear that country A is trying to befriend country B and you don't like that as country C, then you may want to try and head that off, or at least shape events in a way that's not going to harm your own interests, maybe, whether it's trade or a national security concern.
So Netanyahu says this whole report is a blatant lie. What is the evidence that Israel is spying on the U.S.?
Well, Israel has spied on the U.S. Listeners may remember the case of Jonathan Pollard in the 1980s, who was an agent who was busted for supplying tens of thousands of documents to Israel. And that kind of establishes the benchmark for what's widely accepted as Israel's need to keep up to date with its friends, shall we say.
And I'm guessing it's not just Israel. Like, how often do countries spy on their friends?
Well, yes, we shouldn't put Israel in the dock alone on this. Every country does it all the time, particularly the U.S. You'll remember how much trouble President Barack Obama got into for authorizing the essentially wiretapping using similar technology to listen into the phone calls of German Chancellor Angela Merkel in 2013. There was a giant WikiLeaks dump that exposed the extent of U.S. surveillance of its allies. The U.S. in that case had to issue a formal apology and promise never to do it again. Honest. And so there was a lot of righteous anger from European nations, particularly the French and the Germans. But more candid former German and French ministers would say, well, yes, but we do it too. So we're not going to make too much of a stink. We're just jealous of the resources the U.S. can put into this.
And how far back does friend spying on friends go?
So obviously that goes back as far as time. People have always wanted to know what even their friends are up to because it helps give them an edge for different reasons. In terms of electronic surveillance, which we can document more easily, then that goes back as far as the beginning of electronic communications with the telegraph. And one of the most famous and perhaps still to this day most important uses of this signals intelligence was when, during World War I, there was an incident known as the Zimmermann telegram, where Germany sent a cable to Mexico inviting them to join an alliance against the United States. The Brits intercepted it, and they intercepted it by having established a wiretap on a U.S. diplomatic channel, which was supposedly secret. So the Brits, by spying on their friends, the Americans, were able to encourage Americans. So the response in America to this telegram was outrage and helped provide public support for America's entry into World War I. So the Brits intercepted a friendly U.S. cable channel to embarrass the Germans and help draw Americans into the war.
Hey, just staying ahead of the curve.
Exactly.
You've been eavesdropping in on my conversation with the world's history guy, Chris Wolf. Chris, thank you very much.
You're welcome, Marco.
Okay, more bleak news from the world of Brexit. If the UK exits the European Union without a deal, prepare for chaos. Riots in the streets, shortages of food and medicine. These are the warnings contained in the Yellowhammer. That's code name for a newly released report from the British government. Here's the BBC's Rob Watson.
It really is astonishing. I mean, in many ways, it reads like the sort of script of one of those apocalyptic movies that Hollywood makes, you know, when there's been a sort of terrible flood or aliens have taken over. I mean, I'll just go through it briefly. So it talks about a disruption to the supply of fuel, clean water, potentially medicines. It says certain types of fresh food supply would decrease. Businesses would go bankrupt because the price of electricity would go up.
All right. Now, Yellowhammer outlines the worst possible scenarios that could happen in the event of a no-deal Brexit.
I've been a journalist for over 30 years, and I don't think I've ever seen a document like this produced by a British government. I mean, yes, of course, the government will point out this is not a prediction of what would happen if there was a no-deal Brexit, but it is said to be what could happen in a reasonable worst-case scenario.
But hold on, this is Brexit we're talking about here. Brexit is confusing, but one thing is crystal clear. Nothing is straightforward when it comes to Brexit. And naturally, not everybody is buying into this newly released report. Some people are crying wolf. Stephen Canning is with the Epilepsy Society in the UK.
People will see this report and see these headlines and think that this is new information. This report is an old report that was written before our new Prime Minister came in, before a whole new work was done, before we were working with the department to ensure that medicines would continue to supply. So this report is scaremongering. This report is not necessary.
According to the Yellowhammer report, people with epilepsy could be among the many impacted by shortages in medical supplies. Stephen Canning says the Epilepsy Society is not worried, though. Plans to prevent this scenario are already in place.
We are quite confident that an exit, whether that's an orderly exit or a no-deal exit, will not have any impact on our supporters and those people living with epilepsy. We're confident that the arrangements put in place by the Department for Health will ensure that medicine continues to be supplied. And we will keep ensuring we work with the department to make sure that that is the case.
So it sounds like you're not too concerned by this Yellowhammer document. As you say, it's been out for a while, but I mean, here's the thing. On one hand, there are people saying this report is scaremongering. On the other hand, if I had some critical medical condition, I would be very concerned. So what do you advise patients to do?
So completely, I understand that this report will scare people and this report will make people panic. And, you know, my advice is don't. Go onto the Department for Health website or go onto the epilepsy website, where we have clear updates of the availability of medicine. You can also read the discussions we've had with the department, where we've made it clear that what measures need to be put in place, and the department has agreed and they're putting those in place to ensure the availability of medicine.
So maybe things won't turn out as bad as the government-authored Yellowhammer report predicts. On the other hand, it is Brexit. Things could turn out worse. Let's hope not. No dynasty can last forever. In the Basketball World Cup in China, the French team took it to the Americans and bounced them right out of the tournament last night.
Finds his way into the lane and drives and scores!
The French team stunned the Americans. Team USA had won 58 straight games in World Cup and Olympics hoops competition, Olympic gold in 2008, 2012, and 16.
The U.S., their last loss back in the 2006 semifinals of the World Cup Championship.
After 13 years, the Americans were vulnerable. America's best talent declined to play. No LeBron, no Steph Curry, no James Harden. Why risk an injury for a tourney most American fans were not even aware of? Still, gotta give it up for the French.
Down low, Gobert with the two-handed flush.
They beat the Americans 89-79.
As France comes in, and with 0.9 seconds about to wrap up what is to be a historic victory.
So Team USA is out and France plays Argentina in a semifinal tomorrow. Spain and Australia will meet in the other semi. Heavily armed Russian troops have been knocking down doors today. More than 1,000 troops spread out across 40 towns and cities. Their target? Kremlin critic Alexei Navalny's regional offices and the homes of activists. Russian authorities say the raids are part of an ongoing investigation into money laundering. Navalny says the raids were ordered by President Vladimir Putin and are all about revenge. Navalny's team helped orchestrate losses for pro-Putin parties in Moscow city elections last weekend. We'll dig further into that tomorrow. For now, here's another area of discontent with the Russian government. Too much trash. Russian officials want to truck garbage from Moscow to northern Russia and build a dump nearly the size of Manhattan. As Charles Maines reports, people in the north, they're not happy about it.
It takes a camouflaged philosopher guide named Yura to find your way through this swamp in Russia's northern Arkhangelsk province. The forces of darkness are in retreat, he says. The forces of light on the rise. Yura talks like this a lot, about good, about evil, darkness and light. Stark metaphors that make sense, sort of. Once you get to where you're going, a remote railway station called Shias. This is where Russian locals have waged a year-long campaign to stop construction of what's probably Europe's largest landfill, a 20-square-mile garbage dump. Russian authorities say it's needed to alleviate Moscow's massive trash problems. They chose Shias for its relative isolation, offering cash and other incentives. It all makes sense, unless you happen to live anywhere nearby. Of course we're against it, says Antocha. A construction worker from the city of Arkhangelsk, 500 miles away. The swamps here feed rivers that extend through the region and feed into the White Sea, he says. Poison Shias with garbage, and you poison the entire north. Anna Shakalova, a shopkeeper from a town just 30 miles from Shias, says construction started illegally and in secret on public lands. Locals only learned about it after hunters came across the dig site by accident. Anna, Antocha, Yura, they're all part of a 100-strong protest movement that spent the past year locked in a standoff with authorities over construction of the landfill. In that time, the Republic of Shias has emerged, a tent commune just outside the dig site. The Republic has its own hymn, flag, infirmary, as well as a makeshift kitchen and bathhouse, even a stage for concerts. Just one strict rule, no drugs or booze. This is a place where liberals mix with nationalists, peaceniks with military vets, businessmen alongside eco-activists. And month after month, they've come to the campsite, some for a few days, others for longer, because, says Anna Shakalova, for northerners, this is war. And if we stay together, it's a war we win. But the battle over Shias has also exposed simmering resentments about the top-down way Russia is governed today. There's a feeling that Russia's regions give their resources to Moscow while getting little, or even worse, garbage in return. It's an example of Moscow's chauvinism against the rest of the country, says Ksenia Dmitrieva, who's 33. Moscow thinks just because they have the money, they can put their trash where they want. They're not better than us. Maybe it's not surprising, then, that many at Shias are angry at the government. And increasingly, that includes President Vladimir Putin. After years of sky-high ratings, Putin's numbers have fallen amid unpopular pension reforms and a sagging economy. Recent polls show Russians' trust in Putin has fallen to just over 30%. A majority now think the country is on the wrong track. Count Lilia Zobova, a business owner, among those who've lost patience with the Russian leader. She says she loved Putin, even voted for him. But seeing Putin ignore countless appeals to overrule the landfill has convinced her of one thing. The president clearly supports what's happening here at Shias. She's disappointed, she says. I don't know who to believe anymore. That afternoon, a helicopter appears on the skyline. For the protesters, it's not good news. The government is flying in diesel and other supplies under armed police guard and the presence of mass private security contractors in an effort to move forward with construction. It's the latest show of force against the Shias camp. Several protesters have already been arrested and given stiff fines.
Но страх есть, ну как бы это нормально то, что есть страх, потому что
It's natural to be afraid, says Irina Leontova, a 28-year-old filmmaker from Syktyvkar, a city 3 hours away. People understand that anything can happen, but still they keep coming. Vera Goncharenko, a retired accountant, says she feels that something is stirring in Russia. Why don't they snuff us out, she says. We've been holding on for a whole year and still they don't. It means they're afraid of us. Besides, she says, they don't talk about Shias on TV. How do we know something like Shias isn't happening elsewhere in Russia? With that, a passing train blows its whistle in support, and the protesters wave back. It's already a tradition here at the camp. Proof that news, like water, always finds its way out of the swamp. For The World, Charles Maynes, Shias, Northern Russia.
As long as we're on the subject of Russian discontent with the status quo, here's some very real dislike. Это жесткий город, своя шкала контрастов. Купеческая мекка, государство в государстве. Тот самый город, что... This is Russian rapper Timati and a song he released last Saturday, the day before Moscow city elections. It's called simply Moscow, an ode, if you will, to the city and to Vladimir Putin. In it, Timati says proudly that he does not go to protests and he does not talk smack about his leaders. He also hails Moscow as a place where they don't allow gay pride parades. So Timati likes things just the way they are. But if YouTube is any gauge, a lot of people don't like Timati's songs. Nearly 1.5 million thumbs down, in fact. So unliked, 3 days later, Timati took the song off YouTube. Timati is a rarity in Russia. Most of the high-profile rappers have thrown their support behind the protesters. But even if you dislike the song and what it says, try to check it out, if you can find it, if only for the gorgeous aerial shots of Moscow. Hey, Timati had a budget for his video, and he spent it. The World comes to you from the Nan and Bill Harris studio at WGBH here in Boston. Hope you can make it back here tomorrow.
The World is a co-production of WGBH Boston, the BBC World Service, PRI, and PRX.